kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you all over the world and all of our sister stations. You can watch this program by going to Ustream channel and searching for Gary Null. Also, we have hundreds and hundreds of small video clips on our own Ustream, but also on our own GaryNull.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com on topics that are of importance to you. They're free. They're there as a public service. They really help you with everything. You name the condition, depression, anxiety, diabetes, little short clips from 4 to about 14 minutes. And it's just to help people. Extra information. Today, we have a lot of information. We're going to talk about how a high-fat diet prompts your immune cells to start eating connections between neurons. Do you remember when I said that, and this is from Georgia Regent University, I said that there is no such thing as being overweight and healthy? Well, this really proves that, and this was published in Brain Behavior and Immunity. Also today, loneliness. And we have so many people in our society who are lonely. People you wouldn't imagine are lonely. Many movie stars. We just had an article that was about Jennifer Lawrence, the Hunger Games actress, who said how lonely she is. She's 25, famous, wealthy, and lonely. Not surprising. But we have people from all walks of life, and frequently the older you get, the more lonely you become because of moving, people dying, loss of friendships, loss of essential people in your life. What does it do to you? An interesting article of what it does from University of Chicago, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. I'll share that and my solution to that. Also, for those of you who've been using your fruit powders or eating fruit or fruit concentrates, boy, have you been ahead of the curve on this. This is from Cree University. They just did a study on raspberries, the extract of raspberries, and how important it is for managing your blood pressure. Well, blood pressure is a major killer. People die of high blood pressure and stroke. So having your raspberry powder, quote, supplements containing a dried raspberry powder from the raspberries may improve blood pressure and help support cardiovascular health. We'll deal more with that. The food industry can help lower cardiovascular disease by adding a little seaweed to products. University of Southern Denmark. How does that work? In fact, last night I had some shiitake mushrooms and hijiki seaweed for my Thanksgiving meal. And I hope all of you went to the website and got some of the recipes that I put out there as a public service. You see, celebrating Thanksgiving means you can be thankful for the things in your life, your friendships, your relationships, your health, the pets that you have, your companion pets, so many things to be thankful for, and taking that moment to be appreciative. But what I'm going to do, it was so popular, I got so many responses over the internet, that each Monday on my website, I'm going, and Facebook, and also on PRN, I'm going to post an original gourmet, vegan, gluten-free recipe. You'll see the photograph taken in my kitchen, the presentation, which I put together, and the original recipe. Now, all of these you can do. Don't be fooled by how beautiful they look, because sometimes you look at something and think, well, that's too complicated. I couldn't do that. Yes, you can. You absolutely can. In fact, at sleepaways, at retreats, I've done cooking classes where I first showed the dish and asked, do you think you can do it? No. And yet at the end of the class, they were all doing it. So I believe that we should be bringing more gourmet, beautifully plated and presented dishes to the table. So I'm going to give you one. It's free. It's a public service. And I'm going to do one per week. And hopefully then you'll add one new item per week. I can promise you that you have not seen these anywhere. They're original. I have about 2,000 original recipes. People didn't realize I'm a chef. Yes, I've been a gourmet chef for a long time. I've owned three of the most successful gourmet vegan restaurants in American history, founding the first gourmet vegetarian restaurant in America, the Fertile Earth. I'm sure some of you listening right now may have eaten there. It was packed every night. I would have still had it, but I was given misinformation when I started on WMCA Radio that I couldn't have a restaurant and do a show because of conflict of interest, so I sold the restaurant and found out later it wasn't true. But be that as it may, it was wonderful. I love being in the restaurant. Those of you who ever ate at Gary's Place on Columbus and 74th when I had it, every Wednesday night I was the chef, no one else in the kitchen. I would knock out about 400 dishes. I only gave two. You had a choice of one or two. But I would go upstairs later and see people taking pictures of them because it's in the presentation. And it doesn't take a lot of skill to be creative. And also recently I was invited by David Boulay, America's greatest chef, the highest Michelin star rating chef, to do a presentation at his place with a small selected group of real gourmet aficionados, and I was happy to do so, gourmet enthusiast. And on the wall, this huge wall, they were showing photographs of my original dishes, and about 400 of them. And then how do you create these? When you think of brown rice, you just think of something boring and bland in a bowl. Well, there are 100 ways you can make that rice exciting. And so that's what I like to do. So you'll have a chance to benefit from that starting Monday. So that's some of what we're going to talk about on health and nutrition today. Also today, James Hansen has done a lot of good for the environment. I have enormous amount of respect for what he has done, the sacrifices he has made, having himself arrested to make his points down in Appalachia, my home country of West Virginia. But he's taken on one issue that I would share a difference of opinion with without showing any less respect for him, and that is he is pro-nuclear. And he's made his points about pro-nuclear. I'll share his pro-nuclear points. But then I'm having on Professor Harvey Wasserman today, who's a professor of history at Columbus State University and Capital University. And he's an investigative journalist to challenge it, to show you why nuclear is the wrong approach for creating energy. And this way, hopefully, Professor Hansen will get this information, and it might realign his thoughts. If not, well, we just have a difference of opinion on this, and we will continue to share similarities on other issues. Also today, I want to share some of my own thoughts, as well as Professor Henry Giroux from some of the more important areas, including from Progressive Network commentary on terrorizing students, the criminalization of children in the United States police state. Why is that important? Because when you and I, if you're over 40, were growing up, we didn't have police in our schools. We actually learned a lot, more than just reading and arithmetic and math. We learned about how to behave, character development, how to think critically, and we were held accountable to standards. You didn't get a C if you really earned an F. You got an F. And then they work with you. The students would work with you. The teachers work with you. The principal, your parents, to see if they couldn't help you. If it meant staying back a session or going to summer school, you did so. That doesn't apply today. So we have a lot of problems in our schools. But that problem in the school didn't originate in the school. It originated outside the school with the militarization of our police. Whenever there is a problem where a police officer has been charged with killing a person, immediately Fox jumps in, always, always siding with the police, instead of staying objective, staying independent till all the facts are in. So we'll talk about that. Also, debt serfdom in America. At the holiday time of the season, when people are deeply in debt, why can't they simply find other gifts of self instead of some material gift that costs them an average of over $800? That's $800 they don't have. So they're putting on plastic, on credit cards. That creates a cycle. And I want to talk about that and breaking that. And the triumph of materialism, the average American will spend $830 during Christmas shopping. And this is from Economic Collapse. Also today, Ben Carson is at it again, using the Bible, quoting it in the literal sense, as if it's absolute for some of his political platforms. Fine. We'll take a look at how the Bible has changed over time. And Ben, obviously, has been reading it. Also, we're going to talk about just a few things on Hillary Clinton. I'm going to be doing a 3-hour special on Hillary Clinton, putting it all together, including the current Harper Magazine article on the Clinton Foundation and what a criminal operation it is. But everything you should know about Hillary Clinton, if you're a Democrat or a corporate Democrat or a liberal or a corporate liberal, and you believe she's the right person. The intent is to allow you to know how deep this pathology goes. And finally, the lie we live. This is going to be an interesting audio clip that raises a lot of important questions for you. We have a packed show. Let's begin. Loneliness, quote, triggers cellular changes that can cause illness. And this is from University of Chicago. I'll read this short piece. Loneliness is more than a feeling. For adults, perceived social isolation is a major health risk that can increase the risk of premature death by 14%. Now, researchers have long known the dangers of loneliness, but the cellular mechanisms by which loneliness causes adverse health outcomes have not been well documented. Now, a team of researchers, including University of Chicago psychologists and leading loneliness expert, has released a study shedding new light on how loneliness triggers physiological responses that can ultimately make us sick. And this was in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So here's the takeaway. Loneliness actually increases the impact upon gene expression and leukocytes. Those are the cells in the immune system that are involved in protecting the body against bacteria and viruses. And as expected, the leukocytes of lonely humans showed the effects of what is called CTRA. That's an increased expression of genes involved in inflammation and a decreased expression of genes involved in antiviral responses, which means that when you're lonely, there's a higher probability of coming down with a viral infection, a bacterial infection, an autoimmune illness, including arthritis. Now, this jumps me back to a meeting I had with Gerald, the former head of psychiatry for the city of New York, who was over at the Institute of Applied Biology, and we were having a discussion one night, and he said that he had this new study showing that people with arthritis had a higher degree of loneliness factored in as a causative factor, because when you overcame the loneliness, when they engaged in healthy relationships where they no longer felt isolated, their arthritis frequently cleared up. Jump ahead all these years, these decades, and here they're proving that. So it's not in your head that when you're lonely, you're sicker more frequently. It's physiologic. It's expressing the genes. So the solution, in my opinion, there's no reason to be lonely. But you cannot find true friendships and relationships that matter over the internet. You have to be able to look someone in the eyes. You have to be able to feel that energy. You have to be able to exchange that energy. And with all the places that people typically go that, in my opinion, are wrong, bars, nightclub, discos, that's not the place to meet people. There are all forms of social activities occurring. For example, there are groups that go to museums, different types of museums, every day. there are film showings. I remember I had a membership for a while at the Museum of Natural History, which I would recommend to you, because they had first showings and unique showings. I saw Joseph Campbell over there one evening and asked him, would he be on the show? And he did. He came on afterwards. He was a friend of John LaBelle, a great professor out at Pratt Institute, and who was friends with him. And I'm thinking, here are all these hundreds of people, and they're all in a good environment, sharing some very progressive energy. They should socialize, and indeed many people do. Going to Broadway shows, going to off-Broadway shows, there are groups doing this all the time. So I definitely recommend that you get out of your environment, turn off the television, turn off the computer, and actively seek ways of engaging with people doing projects. I knew a person who was very lonely down in Florida. Very bright person, but not outgoing, meaning her natural personality was shy. And one day she was at a film screening. I sometimes do film screenings of my newest films for the public in the health community before they're out into on the internet or to other places. And she came up later and she says, I really enjoy coming here twice a year to see your new films. I said, why? She says, the only time I really get out to see anyone. I said, you're kidding. And I suggested, are you aware there's a botanical club where people go and donate their time to help restore gardens all around the place? You're going to meet wonderful human beings. And what kind of person would you likely meet who's out there doing gardening? You're going to meet a different type of person with different energies in alignment with your own. She did. And met and has now a wonderful relationship with one of the persons that she met doing these gardening things together. There's so many things you can do that would help you overcome loneliness and hence disease and early death. This is from Georgia Regent University, published in Brain Behavior and Immunity. Quote, when a high-fat diet causes us to become obese, it also appears to prompt normal, bustling immune systems, cells, in our brain. If we become sedentary and start consuming the connections between our neurons, the good news is going back on a low-fat diet for just 2 months reverses this trend of shrinking cognitive ability as weight begins to normalize. That's according to Dr. Alex Stranham, neuroscientist, Department of Neuroscience, Regenerative Medicine at the Medical College of Georgia. Microglia, eating synapsis, is contributing to synapsis loss and cognitive impairment in obesity, end quote. Now, what can we do about it? Well, I suggest the following. Every single major scientific study on the topic of caloric restriction shows it lengthens our life. Of all the things you could do, eat, take, reducing caloric intake to our actual metabolic needs is how you live a longer life. So we can adjust ourselves by buying larger clothes, but it doesn't work. We're killing our brain. So the takeaway message, if you're overweight, you're more likely to have prematurely aged brain, which means closer you're going to get, quicker you're going to get to cognitive decline, senility, memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's. But we can reverse that in a major way. I'm working with some people right now who have full-blown cognitive decline and looking at the results of a one-year study of major lifestyle changes, and it's showing remarkable benefits. So that's good. So that ties that together. So get off the weight and protect your brain. The food industry can help lower cardiovascular disease by adding a little seaweed to the products. This is from the University of Southern Denmark, published in Psychologia. It says, quote, adding seaweed to processed foods such as frozen pizzas, hot dogs, and dried pasta will reduce cardiovascular disease, concludes a new scientific article. One suggestion is to replace 5% of the flour in pizza dough with dried and granulated seaweed. And then it goes on to talk about why this seaweed is such an important factor and how powerful it is in helping the body's cells and the heart and everything else. Mind you, seaweed is great. It contains few calories. It has it's rich in amino acids and fibers and minerals, including sea minerals, which are good for our thyroid gland. And it can last a long time. So it's good. And so maybe someone out there will come up with some new products. I'm a big believer in supporting people with ideas. So you come up with some new products that contain 5% seaweed, which is not expensive. And in your product, it will not alter the taste, because most seaweed is relatively neutral in taste. But it would make a healthier bread, healthier pizza. And a very popular pizza in the health food stores today is gluten-free, dairy-free, vegan pizzas. I mean, they're very popular. So that's another thing. Add some. And so if you're a home-based business person and you're making some product, add dry seaweed powder. And finally, from Emory University, published Molecular Psychiatry, inflammation, that's what we get when we have coffee, alcohol, fried foods of any kind, linked to weakened reward circuits in depression. Quote, what does inflammation in the context of depression look like inside the brain? Emory researchers have found that high inflammation is linked to, quote, failure to communicate between two parts of the brain, the ventral and the ventromedial, the prefrontal cortex. So, about one-third of people with depression have high levels of inflammation markers in their blood. So what does this mean? Now we know that when you're depressed, your brain is aging prematurely, which then causes destruction of the brain. So if you are depressed, you should get off all pro-inflammatory items and start taking anti-inflammatory. There are nutrients called inflammatory quenchers, cytokine quenchers. These turn off inflammation in the brain. Glycerophosphorylcholine is one. Phosphatidylserine is another. Acetyl-L-carnitine, another. L-carnosine, another. Pycnogenol, another. Resveratrol, another. Vitamin C, another. So, and grape juice. And beet juice. And lemon water. Those can turn off inflammation in the brain. And finally, exercise can reduce heart failure risk at any age. This is from Johns Hopkins University. And here's what it has to say. Starting to exercise later in life, that means after the age of 40, can still reduce the risk of heart failure, and even modest increases in activity can provide some protection. And that was presented at the annual meeting of the American Heart Association. So that's good. They looked at 11,000 American men and women for a period of time, 45 to 64 years of age, and looked at it from over 6 years. 150 minutes of moderate exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise per week. I would double that to get maximum results. 300 minutes a week of moderate exercise and 150 minutes a week of really strong exercise. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Triumph of materialism, because a holiday season should not be to celebrate being able to buy gifts that people generally don't want with money you don't have, to create debt you cannot pay back. It should be to celebrate life, joy, love, happiness, and service to others. Being able to take time to help feed the homeless, That's important. To find, if you're going to get a gift, get gloves, a scarf, a toboggan, something that a person in the cold of winter who is homeless would benefit from. That is a gift worth buying. Any other gift? Make it. Write it. Create it. Do a video, a song, a poem, a parody, something someone else that you care about would appreciate because it came from you. And yet, that's not the direction we're going. Has there ever been a major holiday more focused on materialism than the modern American Christmas? This year, Americans are planning to spend an average $830 on Christmas gifts, which represents a jump of $110 over the average $720 last year. But have our incomes gone up accordingly? Of course not. In fact, real median household income in the United States has been experiencing a steady long-term decline. So in order to fund all of our Christmas spending, what do? Well, the obvious. We go into debt. We love to pull out our credit cards and spend money that we do not have on lots of cheap, useless stuff made on the other side of the world by workers making slave labor wages. We do the same thing year after year, and most of us have grown accustomed to the endless cycle of growing debt. In fact, one Pew survey found that approximately 70% of all Americans believe that debt is a necessity in their lives. But then we have to work our fingers to the bone to try to make the payments on all that debt. Not realizing that debt systematically impoverishes us, it may be hard to believe, but if you have a single dollar in your pocket and no debt, you have a greater net worth than 25% of all Americans. That's $1 in your pocket and no debt. Sounds crazy, but it's true. Overall, when you add up all forms of debt, consumer, business, local government, and federal government, Americans are more than $60 trillion in debt. That does not include unfunded or underfunded entitlements. That would add another $120 trillion onto it. 40 years ago, that number was $3 trillion. Today, it's 60. That's where we've gone. We have been on the greatest debt binge in history of the world. Even though we are the wealthiest and most prosperous nation on the planet, we always had to have more. We just kept on borrowing and borrowing and borrowing from the future until we completely destroyed it. And now we're looking to take money from some of our programs, which, by the way, has been done for a long time, Social Security. I want you to hear what one person said about protecting Social Security from the thieves in the night. This was just night before last.
I'd like to talk about a budget point of order that I'm going to be put forward. This legislation does something that many in this body have been critical of in the past. It actually takes money from the obligations to Social Security and transfers them to a more immediate program. Specifically written into the budget rules, though, were rules that say, you know what, if you're going to take money, if you're going to steal money from Social Security, from people who are retired who have put it in there, and you're going to spend it on something else, that there is a special budget point of order that says, in order to do this, you will need 60 votes. So we will be putting forward a budget resolution that says, do you know what? If you're going to steal money from Social Security, if you're going to take money from Social Security and you're going to spend it on other concerns, people say, oh, well, we're going to spend it on disability. Well, the Social Security Fund was put forward as a pension plan. You have an obligation to those who put the money in. So stealing money from people who will be getting money in the future to pay for immediate concerns is robbing Peter to pay Paul. So those in this body will be asked tonight to vote on whether or not you're willing to vote to take money from Social Security to spend it on immediate concerns. This is sort of like saying, all right, I have a pension fund. Let's say I have $100,000 in my pension plan, but I want to go to the racetrack. And I need some money this week, so I'm willing to take the $100,000 out, and I'm willing to pay a $30,000 penalty, but I'm willing to do it because I am an addict, and I am addicted to spending, and I've got to spend the money now. That's what it is, and you're all guilty of it, right and left. You're going to take money out of the Social Security Fund, and you're going to spend it on an immediate...
You heard it. Now, did you hear about this? Did you read it in any of the newspapers? This is the problem of our government. The entire system of our government is failed. We need a new government. We have to dismantle every single bureaucracy and start over and do it right this time. Without greed, without private contractors, there's 300,000 private contractors who feed off fear and special connections with legislators and power brokers, lobbyists, and consultants in Washington. It's just one giant feeding frenzy. We pay for it. And yet what we really need, really needing better schools, we need to have shelters for homeless. We need to have drug interdiction programs in every city in America to help people get off the drugs they're on and decriminalize it. We need to have places where senior citizens can come in some form of shared assisted living, holistic communities. We could put those in every community in America, and that would serve a greater purpose. It would help people in the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years of their life have quality of life. We should have bridges, tunnels, gas mains that are fixed. We should have high-speed rail that can go from New York to L.A., from Boston to Florida to Texas. That's where we should be putting our money. We should reforest America. And we're not spending it there. We're spending it on these worthless campaigns of violence around the world. And yet no one knew that they were stealing, as they've been doing for a long time, from Social Security. So just good to know that someone, at least on that single issue, is doing something to notify us. I'm going to do an in-depth discussion on debt serfdom in America on our next program. I want to share some insights now because a lot of you have told me that you're concerned about what's happening, that the media has been in substantial denial of the underlying causes of the crimes against humanity in the United States. It's one thing when you have 18 million children who do not have food for all their needs. They're food insecure in the United States. When you have 1.6 million homeless school children, when you have a nation's medical industrial complex that is utterly corrupt, totally failed, greedy beyond belief, and doctors who are dumber than bricks, not even doing science-based medicine. That's a fraud. It's a lie. And then you have someone go to school hyped up on caffeine and sugar, deprived of sleep, and you diagnose them with a disease that does not exist and give them a drug that can only cause more problems. And then one day, little Johnny goes to school and kills a lot of people, and we say it's the gun. It's not the damn gun. Why aren't you looking at the real underlying cause of 98% of all the mass shootings? It's not based upon their ethnicity. It's not based upon their religious beliefs. It's based upon the medications they were taking and how these medications alter a person's normal brain chemistry and hence perception. The side effects of the medications alone show that suicidal ideation, homicidal tendencies, rage, paranoia, delusional psychoses are the actual effects, not side effects, effects of these medications. And we've got 10 million kids on them. The only question I have is why in the hell haven't we seen 10 times the amount of mass shootings? But we will in time. Are we honest about it? No, we're not, because we right now are incapable about being honest about anything of relevance in the United States. We are a nation in complete denial of the truth. As brutalism comes to shape every public encounter, democratic values and the ethical imagination wither under the weight of neoliberal capitalism and post-racial racism, given way to the poisonous logics of self-interest, privatization, unfettered drive for wealth. Kids are coming out of school today with one issue only, if they're an Ivy League school, more often than not. How do I succeed? Get to the top. not about the ethics of getting to the top, not about whether or not we should be having more in a world that has fewer resources. We want it all. And whatever we end up having, it's never enough. We want more. Insatiable addiction to power. Under the regime of predatory neoliberalism, compassion and respect are viewed increasingly with contempt, while the spectacle of violence titillates and the multitudes moves the markets. The more violent something is, the more attention it gains. A free market mentality now drives and corrupts politics, destroys social protection, celebrates a hyper-competitiveness, and deregulates economic activity. All human activities, practices, and institutions are now subject to the market. Public goods such as toll roads, libraries, schools are privatized as the very idea of the common good becomes an object of disdain. Consequently, under such circumstances, governing principles such as equality, justice, and fairness begin to disappear from the discourse of politics. As politics is emptied of any sense of social responsibility, the apostles of casino capitalism preach that allegedly amoral economic activity exacts no social cost. Really, then please come with me when I do my next film, which I'm doing now, and you'll see how much what you do in Washington, Wall Street, in the media centers, how much it actually costs the people you will never look in the eyes. One consequence is a vast growing landscape of human suffering amplified by a mass-mediated metaphysics of retribution and violence that more and more creeps into every commanding institution of U.S. society, now serving myriad functions such as sports, spectacle, entertainment, and punishment. The neoliberal machinery of social death increases every day, reaching to every corner of American society, dissolving the bonds of socially committed higher levels of ideals and undermining social obligations. One outcome is the proliferation of neglect, exploitation, and suffering among these diverse populations, including poor and uneducated middle-class whites, who are dying prematurely and unnecessarily in an epidemic of substance abuse, suicide, and poor health. Neoliberalism's unbridled social Darwinism, elimination of social provisions and culture of cruelty forces people out of Medicaid, pushes millions into poverty. Why? Increasingly, institutions such as schools, prisons, detention centers, and other major economic and cultural social institutions are being organized around the production of violence. Rather than promote democratic values and a respect for others and embrace civic values, they often function largely to humiliate, punish, and demonize any vestige of social responsibility. Violence permeates and drives foreign policy, dominates popular culture, and increasingly is used to criminalize a wide range of social behaviors, especially among Black and Latino youth. Violence functions as a brutalizing practice used by the state to squelch dissent, incarcerate poor people, people of color, terrorize immigrants, wage a war on minority youth, and menace individuals and groups considered disposable, or worse yet, a threat. Protesting, you're a threat. Stand up and speak out, you're a threat. Shake your fist in the air, you're a threat. Not only does such violence destroy the conditions and institutions necessary to develop a democratic polity, it also accelerates abusive forms of punitive control and extends from the prisons to other institutions such as schools. In this instance, violence becomes the ultimate force propagating what might be called the punishment creep. The punishing creep that has moved from prisons to other public spheres now has a firm grip on both schools and the daily rituals of everyday life. Margaret Kimberly captures one instance of the racist underside of punishment creep. She writes, "Black people are punished for driving, for walking down the street, for having children, for putting their children in school, for acting the way children act, and even for having children who are killed by other people. We are punished, in short, because we still exist." Violence in the United States has always been defined partly by a poisonous mix of chauvinism, exceptionalism, terrorism that runs through a history marked by genocidal assaults against Native Americans, the brutality of slavery, and a persistent racism that extends from the horror of lynchings and the chain gangs to current patterns of mass incarceration, which subject many black youths to the shameful dynamics of the school-to-prison pipeline and unprecedented levels of police abuse. Violence is the premier signature of those individuals and groups who have signed on, either actively or passively, to complicity in everything from police shootings to real estate redlines, which crowds blacks into substantial amounts of substandard housing in dangerous neighborhoods. The dream is about the totality of white supremacy in American history and its cumulative weight on African Americans. Police violence against black people has become highly visible and thrust into the national spotlight as a result of individuals recording acts of police abuse with their cell phones and other new technologies. In the last few years, there have been what seems like a torrent of video footage showing unarmed black people being assaulted by the police. For instance, there is the shocking video of Walter Scott being shot in the back after fleeing from his car. Eric Garner dying as a result of being put in a chokehold by a white policeman who accused him of illegally selling cigarettes. The tragic killing of Freddie Gray, who, after making eye contact with a police officer, was put in a police van and purposely given a jarring ride that resulted in his death. And the unbearable shooting of a 12-year-old Tamira Rice for playing with a pellet gun in the snow in a park. All of these deaths are morally indefensible, and yet our president defends them. Because, understand something, friends, he alone has the power to stop it all. And he could. The Attorney General acts at the orders of the president. If he demanded an end to the militarization of police, if he demanded the police stop shooting first and asking questions later, if he went to every city and brought in investigations and said, if you are found guilty, you will go to jail, how quickly things would change. If he changed the way police are trained not to view everything first as if it were a domestic terrorist attack, if he brought in humanistic psychologists to explain to these new cadets, some of whom are war-weary veterans suffering post-traumatic stress disorder who become police, if they really gave the local police boards the power to take people off the force, if they had the courage to challenge the police unions, then you would see a substantial reduction. If he decriminalized all drugs so nobody was then arrested to put them in prison in the first place, and if he stopped search and frisk completely, it would be a different environment. In part, this is not going to happen because the militarization of schools and the accompanying surge of police officers are driven by the fear of school shootings, particularly in the aftermath of the Columbine High School tragedy in 1999 and the massacre that took place at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2013. Well, I know Michael Moore, and I showed Michael film footage privately of when I shot for my drugging of our children after he had released his Bowling for Columbine. His was about the guns. Mine was about the drugs. And he came back in, to his credit, and I commend him for this, and he filmed a segment for the drugging of our children and later Prescription for Disaster, two separate ones, on the fact that these kids, Eric Harris, was on drugs. And the kids that I interviewed said, Eric was normal until he started taking these drugs like Effexor. And also, what do we have at Sandy Hook? Drugs. Not street drugs, pharmaceutical drugs. Look at more than 100 shootings, and you'll find that the kids were on psychiatric drugs. But the psychiatric industry, which is the pharmaceutical industry combined with psychiatry, has so much power over the media that it's a third rail. You're not allowed to touch it. Well, both of these have accelerated the way the present wave of paranoia that followed the terrorist attacks 9/11. What advocates of putting police in schools refuse to acknowledge is that the presence of the police in schools has done nothing, zero, zip, to stop such mass shootings. While the fear of school shootings are overestimated, the fact remains that schools are still one of the safest places for children to be. Caught under the weight of a culture of fear and a rush to violence, many young people in schools are the most recent victims of a punishing state in a society that remains in a state of permanent, endless war, a war that is waged through militarized policies at home and abroad. And until we understand this, we will continue it. Right now, in the state of Texas, there were 100,000 misdemeanor tickets given to school kids last year alone for just doing normal things. That is unfortunate. One kid with Asperger's syndrome, and if you understand Asperger's syndrome, kids will spurt out curse words, was fined $364 because he made a curse word in a classroom. If that were happening when I was growing up, the teacher would have understood, the students would have understood, and the parents would have understood. You don't punish someone who has a brain chemical imbalance. You work with them, and it's a process. It takes time. That's how stupid our system has become. It is an insult. Our entire educational system is now an insult in how we have looked at children now as the enemy. They're not the enemy. They're the future. Similarly, a number of civil rights groups have reported that the presence of police in schools often means more suspensions, which disproportionately affect minority students. Many of the young people who end up in the court are poor black and brown students, along with students with disabilities. And yet it's not being changed. It's only being encouraged. Why? Because once we create an act, a rule, a law, someone profits from it. And many of these police come from privatized police institutions, companies, corporations. They make money. Take the money, take the profit incentive out of all this, and boy, would you see a shrinking of the police presence and the criminalizing process. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. Our newsmaker today is Professor Harvey Wasserman. We're going to go to Harvey in a moment. I gave you his background as a professor of history at Columbus State College and Capital University in Ohio, an investigative journalist. And he's worked tirelessly for over 45 years. He was on trying to share the downside of nuclear power and help close some of the plants. He's helped close many plants. And we're going to go to him in a second to talk about Dr. James Hansen's nuclear beliefs. I just want to mention two things. We have been waiting a long time to have premiums sent out to our sister stations, WBAI, and they're ready, but the station hasn't picked them up. Are there any volunteers who could come by either Sunday or Monday, pick them up, get them to the station so they can be sent out? I'm sure everyone would really like to have their premiums. They're all set to go. In fact, my premiere of Saving the Planet One Bite at a Time raised over $11,000, and I paid for these, and so it works. My hope is that we'll use more people who have films or books, can do lectures or artists, to raise money for the station in the future, because there's no cost to the station. It's virtually all profit to them, and we contribute it as a public service. So call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Also, I have shared with the National Office positive ideas of how to help the stations raise funds. I haven't heard back from them. My hope is that they will engage this. But also, I have shared with the National Office a very specific challenge that there are some investigations they need to do, including sexual abuse by individuals within Pacifica. I have interviewed in depth one of the victims. I have put this person in touch with the executive director, at the time, and the station manager. And it's important, just like with Bill Cosby. Nothing happens for a long time because you didn't know something was happening. But this person claims that many people were abused. If you know someone who was abused, they should call my office. We will speak with them, and so that we can open up an official investigation to determine the merits of sexual abuse within Pacifica. 646-926-5422. That includes sexual assault. Okay? Let's say hello to Harvey. Hi, Harvey.
Gary, how are you?
Doing good.
It's always a pleasure to listen to you. You are so incredibly articulate.
Harvey, we have an issue right now. We both respect James Hansen and all the work he's done. But on this particular and single issue, I happen to share a difference of opinion, as I know you do, because climate scientist James Hansen is off to Paris to promote nuclear power and attack environmental groups in the lead-up to the UN 21 climate conference coming up shortly. The press release announced his visit to Paris berates environmentalists for failing to support, quote, safe and environmentally friendly nuclear power, end quote, which misses the point entirely. So would you go through, for the people who would be confused by this, all the facts concerning why we should be concerned about nuclear power? And I will see that Dr. Hansen has given a transcript and a copy of today's program and your response.
Well, it's unfathomable why anybody who cares about this planet would advocate nuclear power. It's a proven catastrophe, from Fukushima back to Chernobyl back to Three Mile Island and countless other accidents. The nuclear power plants are major contributors to global warming. They kind of eliminate the middleman in that they emit enormous quantities of heat directly into the planet, directly into the water and into the air. All nuclear plants are huge heat producers, completely unbalancing the ecosystems, wiping out billions of marine creatures and God knows what else. They are extremely expensive and very inefficient producers of electricity, far less efficient than renewables. And we're in the midst of a technological revolution here, which is being hampered by atomic energy. Every dollar spent on nuclear power slows the transition to a solartopian green powered economy, which is the only one that's going to be able to sustain our existence on this planet. Dr. Hansen's support of nuclear power has been quite inexplicable to those of us who are concerned about the planet. And nuclear power does emit carbon, by the way, as you all know, Gary, through the mining, the milling, the processing of fuel. There is some radioactive carbon that comes out of all nuclear plants anyway. And then, of course, we have the immense ecological costs of trying to manage the wastes. So nuclear power is a proven failure, and these reactors need to shut as soon as possible. We need to stop wasting money on building new ones and put all our money into renewable resources. There's just no reason not to. If you look at the cost curves and the efficiency curves, they're in the exact opposite direction. The more we have nuclear power, the worse it gets, apparently. Whereas with renewables, the costs are plummeting and the efficiency is rising. And Germany, the world's fourth largest economy, has decided to make transition entirely to renewables. And there were, we have three U.S. cities now who've done it, and it's just, this is the future. I have no idea why Dr. Hansen will be throwing his lot in with a dead technology.
Some years ago, when I was writing and directing Knocking on the Devil's Door, Deadly Nuclear Legacy, I met with a woman named Mrs. Merrill, of Merrill Lynch, and she was an advocate of closing down Indian Point. She was the one who informed me that when she went up and down the streets of her block speaking with women and their daughters who had no known risk factors for breast cancer. They all had this very high level breast cancer. And then I wrote an article with Ernest Sternglass, Professor Ernest Sternglass, who just passed this last year, and Dr. Jay Gould, who was working in the Environmental Protection Agency at Jimmy Carter. And we wrote an article showing that over 50,000 deaths occurred from the failure that we had at Three Mile Island in young babies, and we actually showed where the statistics had been changed. But we got the original statistics before they were changed, and then we showed the statistics after. Also, we showed that there were hot spots all around every nuclear facility in the United States as far as breast cancer incidents went, all cancers. So we could prove that if you live within a certain instance of nuclear power plants, when they were decommissioned, the cancer incidence went down, and we showed that also. When a plant was closed down, suddenly over the next 10 years, breast cancer rates went way down. So on that level of causing cancer, we know that that's the case. We also know that if there's simply one accident that cannot be repaired at Indian Point, it sits on a fault line. We also have the potential for terrorist attacks and solar storms, whatever would make it go Fukushima, you would be putting 20 million Americans who live within 50 miles of that plant at risk with no evacuation plans. We would cause massive amounts of death, the largest amount of injury and death in world history in a short period of time if Indian Point goes. There's no need for Indian Point. We should decommission it, close it down, and yet Hansen is wanting us to actually have more of those.
Yes, it's insane. And Gary, you mentioned in passing the terrorist threat. Two things. We've experienced this horrific situation with ISIS, but anyone who's really seriously concerned about terrorism needs to force these reactors shut as fast as possible. They are incredibly vulnerable. We know from the records that Al-Qaeda did consider hitting Indian Point with a terrorist attack, and at this moment, as we speak, there's a very serious situation that getting zero media coverage. The war in Ukraine, for various reasons, terrorists have knocked out power lines going into Crimea, and having done this, the unintended consequence is major threats to the nuclear reactors in Ukraine, because all nuclear power plants need backup power, and with the power lines going down there, the backup power into a number of reactors has been compromised. And this underscores the fact that ISIS or any other terror group could turn a commercial atomic reactor into an atomic holocaust, in a very short period of time with very little effort.
That just happened last night to 2.5 million citizens of Ukraine with no power. Also think of Pakistan. Pakistan has anywhere between 80 to 120 nuclear facilities. It is politically unstable, and it is corrupt completely. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that the terrorists would be able to bribe someone to get access to nuclear materials. And so we're living in a situation where we should have no nuclear in the world at all. And yet China is now anticipating putting 400 new nuclear facilities in. And when he came into office, Dick Cheney said one of his plans was to incorporate over 1,000 new nuclear facilities. Obama's pro-nuclear. So final comments to James Hansen, who's done a lot of good, and we have to keep that in mind when it comes to helping us on environmental issues, where he's suggesting this simply is wrong-headed.
It's a terrible thing, James Hansen, to have the advocacy of nuclear power on your shoulders, because if anything goes wrong, God forbid, and we know something will, Gary, it's on the shoulders of those who've advocated this technology when they really should know better.
And let him go to Fukushima and look at the results of 100,000 gallons every day since it went into the ocean, going into the ocean and creating massive 1,000-mile-long dead zones where nothing exists. Let him take a look at the seals of Alaska where the fur is coming off, lesions on the body. It's not due to a parasite. It's due to radiation. We're now finding radiation in fish and in bluefin tuna in the Pacific. So why in the world, knowing what we know about how dangerous they are and how impossible it is to really fix them, look, Fukushima hasn't been fixed yet. we just forgot about it, but it's still going on. I can't understand his advocacy, but hopefully he will have a change of mind. Thanks a lot, Harvey.
Thank you, Gary. Anytime.
Professor Harvey Wasserman from Columbus, Ohio, giving us his input. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.